Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, welcome everyone, welcome. In the second half of today's show, we'll escape into the world of fiction with New York Times bestselling author Jennifer Haig. If you were with us last week, Jennifer was slated to join us on the show, but she got stuck at the airport for more than 6 hours, poor baby, and couldn't make it. So we ended up playing an interview I'd done with Dr. Amen on the power of the female brain. Which was a great interview, by the way. If you missed it, you can catch it on conversationslive.net on podcast. But first, today, we're sharing what we really need to know about shingles. And just to give you some statistics here, nearly 1 million Americans every year receive care for shingles or its complications. And Americans make 2.1 million doctor visits a year because of shingles or its complications. The average cost for treating shingles is $525 a person, or $566 million each year. And that was those numbers are quite old, so it's probably gone up a little. And people age 65 and older are seven times more likely to get shingles than the non-elderly. Now, I always thought you could only get shingles if you'd had chicken pox. What I learned from my interviews was that that's not true. I also thought that, shingles was relatively mild and innocuous until I had it myself and found out it's very, very painful. And I learned during the course of my interviews that it actually can be life-threatening. There are some very serious complications around shingles. So I talked with two experts on this subject, Seattle dermatologist Dr. Erin Moore, who shared generalities of shingles and some of the complications, and also New York specialist Dr. Robert Duarte, who focuses on post-herpetic neuralgia, which is the pain that can stick around after shingles is gone, and it can actually last a lifetime following an outbreak of shingles. And we'll also shine a personal light on shingles by talking with a listener about her father's experience. Let me just tell you that I did both of these interviews last week. This is the very first time we're bringing them to you today, but I did tape them. And let me interview my first guest. It was Dr. Erin Moore here in Seattle at the Polyclinic. It was my first interview. She earned her medical degree from the University of Washington. She completed an internship in internal medicine at Virginia Mason Medical Center and a residency in dermatology at the University of Washington Medical Center. And Dr. Moore is certified by the American Board of Dermatology. Currently, as I said, she practices with a polyclinic right here in Seattle. Here is Dr. Erin Moore. Dr. Moore, I'd read, and I'm sure most people know, that shingles is caused by a virus that lies dormant from chickenpox. But talk to us a little bit more about that. And what's happening in the body when it's lying dormant?
So what happens with the shingles virus is it's caused by the varicella virus, which is the same thing that causes chickenpox. And most people, until they had the chickenpox vaccine, got chickenpox. So the majority of adults now have had chickenpox, and so they are at risk for developing shingles because what happens when you get chickenpox is the varicella zoster virus lies dormant in the part of the nerve roots. And then if at a certain point in your life, you have what we think causes the reactivation is you have some sort of decrease in your immune system ability to keep that virus suppressed. And whether that's because you are undergoing like a major chemotherapy, or just have something that puts you at slightly, your immune system at slightly suppressed, say an illness or a stressful period of your life, that puts you at risk for having this reactivation occur.
And I read that typically people over 60 are more susceptible, but, you know, I know a lot of people who've had it in their 30s and 40s even.
Yeah, so it is more common for people to have it occur when they are older, but it can happen at any age. I've seen it happen even in children. So it can happen in any age, but it's less likely to happen just because our immune system naturally becomes a little bit less effective as we get older. So your immune system surveillance is less as you age, so the tendency to have the reactivation occur is greater.
Okay. And you just mentioned the vaccine. It sounds as though you are for the vaccine, but it is somewhat controversial, isn't it?
Well, it's not so much controversial. We just don't know exactly how effective it is. It hasn't been around for a terribly long time, so we don't have a tremendous amount of data. Our data does suggest that it decreases the risk of developing shingles by about 50%, but it doesn't. We're still collecting data on that, and the real controversy is when should people get the shingles vaccine, and it used to be over the age of 60, and now they've actually decreased that to 50. So people can now get the should be able to get the shingles vaccine if they're over the age of 50, and it decreases your risk of developing shingles by about 50 to 60%. But it also decreases your risk if you were to get shingles of postherpetic neuralgia, which is a long-term pain syndrome that's associated with shingles.
Okay. Now, if you haven't had chickenpox at all, can you still get shingles? Because I was surprised when I was doing my research that people who handle infectious diseases manage shingles many times. So can you catch it from somebody?
So you can get shingles if you have not had the chickenpox. Generally speaking, we think that if you catch the virus, so it is very infectious. So if somebody has shingles, they can transmit the virus to somebody else. Usually, if they have not had chickenpox, that will manifest itself as chickenpox rather than shingles. But you can get shingles even if you haven't had chickenpox, because sometimes the chickenpox can be very mild or even subclinical. And I have actually seen cases of shingles in patients who have had the chickenpox vaccine. So they've never had chickenpox, but they have shingles after they've had the vaccine. So it's certainly possible.
Okay, interesting. And most people who have chickenpox typically get it once. They do, as I understand, get it in rare occasions more than once. But with shingles, is that the same case? I'm thinking of one person I know who's had it 3 or 4 times.
So generally speaking, your chances of having it again are low. The recurrence rate is about 4%. So if you have shingles once, it's unlikely that you'd have it again, but you can get it again. And again, if you have a decrease in your immune system, that is more likely. So you're at a higher likelihood to have a recurrence if you're undergoing chemotherapy, if you have some immune suppressive condition such as HIV or others.
Okay, great. And one of the things that I saw over and over when I was looking through reports was that shingles is often misdiagnosed the first time around. In fact, that happened to me. I was told I had insect bites, and it turned out to be shingles. So I understand there are often symptoms before we see that rash. What kind of symptoms would we be looking for?
Oftentimes have a pre-herpetic phase where they have sort of burning, they describe it as sort of burning pain, stabbing pain. Sometimes this can be associated with skin changes that look like just redness, but sometimes there can be no skin changes at all because what you're feeling is actually the reactivation of the virus within the nerve. So there may not be no outward symptoms at all, but people have this sort of pain that's usually described as shooting, stabbing, burning, and it's usually pretty localized to one area because this will the virus reactivates within a nerve root, so it usually follows the pattern of a nerve. One of the most frequent places is on the back. The problem with the fact that there can be this pain is that people can mistake it for other things. So especially if there's no skin changes, it can be mistaken for back pain, urinary tract infection, a whole lot of things. So it can mimic other things.
Now, should a person...
Very commonly misdiagnosed.
Okay, good to know. So if somebody's having pains like this and they're kind of wondering, should they go to their regular doctor? You're a dermatologist. I mean, how do you recommend people handle this?
Well, I think seeing your primary care provider is obviously the best first step. If you do have skin changes and you see a dermatologist regularly, it's not a bad idea actually to go in to see your dermatologist. Just because sometimes we have a better ability to distinguish between common skin conditions, and I always have shingles and other viral infections kind of in the back of my mind because I know they can mimic other things, and I also know that the treatment for them is very low risk, and initiating treatment early it will help heal it faster and also prevent some of the complications. So I would say going to your primary care provider is always a good first step, but if you do have sort of skin findings, I think that if you are able to see a dermatologist, it may benefit you.
And what kind of medication do you give? And then the second part of that question is, if you don't catch it early enough, does that medication even work?
So the medications that are used are antivirals, and the most common of them being either Valtrex or Valacyclovir or Acyclovir. Sometimes people use Famcyclovir. And these medications essentially stop viral replication, and they have been shown to improve the time to healing as well as decrease the risk of developing postherpetic neuralgia. There's controversy over when treatment is indicated, and there are some old research studies that have stated that if you don't initiate treatment within the first 48 to 72 hours, then it's not effective. But newer research actually is indicating that any time you initiate that treatment, it can be beneficial. So that's the only reason I say seeing a dermatologist may be better, though there may be primary care providers that are aware of this research, just because if anybody comes in and has symptoms of shingles or it looks like they have shingles or a herpes virus infection, I always treat. The medications are extremely safe. There are very few side effects to them, and the benefit that the patient may get from the treatment outweighs any risk of the medication. The other medications that can be used in in more severe cases are prednisone, which can help with the inflammation and provide a lot of relief for people, as well as there are some medications that can be used to prevent the development of postherpetic neuralgia in certain situations. And these medications are usually antidepressants sometimes anti-seizure medications that are used and can be helpful with the pain or postherpetic neuralgia.
Okay. And then if we could look at some of the complications of shingles, I was quite surprised to see how many complications. Obviously, infection of the blisters is one of the issues that people run into. But some of the complications were even life-threatening.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody has their immune system is highly suppressed, they can get disseminated varicella go all over their body and can actually get into their organ systems, including the brain, and people can die. There can be complications if it affects one of the nerve roots on the face. It also innervates the eye. You can get herpetic keratitis, and that can be quite devastating and can lead to blindness. So anytime I see somebody that may have shingles in a certain location of the face, specifically, even if it's not right at the eye, but if it's located on the tip of the nose, I always have them seen by ophthalmology to ensure that there's no involvement of the eye, because the treatment is a little bit different for that. It can also, if it involves the face, be involved with the facial nerve, and people can have things like Bell's palsy, where they have actual like a paresis of their part of their face and the inability to close their eye. So those are complications. The herpes or varicella in the eye is not an uncommon complication, actually.
Right. Final thoughts that you'd like to leave listeners with about shingles? What, you know, anything we haven't discussed that they should know?
I guess my biggest advice to listeners is if they have a concern that they might have shingles or have any of the symptoms such that we talked about, like the burning, stabbing pain, redness, or a rash that's in a certain part, just localized, that has those kind of associated symptoms, have a very low threshold for going to see their doctor, just because the initiation of treatment, the treatment is very low risk, and it can improve their symptoms and also decrease the risk of any complications or developing the pain syndrome. So just have a very low threshold for seeking care.
Okay, great. Dr. Erin Moore, thank you so much for your great advice there. I appreciate you being with us today.
No problem. Thanks very much.
And again, that was Dr. Erin Moore. Thank her for giving such great advice there. She's with the Polyclinic right here in Seattle. You can find them at polyclinic.com, polyclinic.com, or at 206-329-1777, 206-329-1777. And coming up next, I talked with Dr. Robert Duarte, who specializes in the post-herpetic treatment of shingles. And before I introduce him, I just want to say we had a call from a listener asking if there is a vaccine for shingles, and there is indeed a vaccine for shingles. I believe Dr. Erin Moore mentioned the name on the podcast, on the tape that we just played to you, but I can look it up and we'll tell you after Dr. Robert Duarte what the name of that is. But your doctor, any doctor should know, the name of the vaccine, shingles. In fact, I've even seen, I go to the grocery store all the time, and they're promoting get your shingles vaccine here. And just as a matter of interest, you know, some people have mixed feelings about vaccines. I'd read there was a little controversy around them because certain studies said that they had not been, the studies had not been conducted on people who'd already had shingles, and they don't work if you're already having an outbreak. But certainly if you've never had one, both doctors I spoke with, both Dr. Erin Moore and Dr. Robert Duarte, were very pro-vaccine. So we're talking to your doctor about, to the listener who just called in. All right, so let me introduce Dr. Robert A. Duarte. He is the director of the Pain Center at North Shore LIJ's Cushing Neuroscience Institute in Manhasset, New York. He's board certified in neurology, pain medicine, and headache medicine. And as I said, he typically sees shingles patients who are dealing with post-herpetic neuralgia, and that's the intense pain that some people are left with, some for a lifetime after an outbreak of shingles. So let's bring that interview to you right now, Dr. Robert A. Duarte. You said you see people normally like 6 months after they've had shingles when they're still dealing with severe pain. The pain is excruciating for many people.
Yes, the pain is one of the, you know, we treat here at our pain center many different pain conditions, from back pain, neck pain, you know, pain in the feet, pain, head pain. But post-herpetic neuralgia, which is defined as, you know, shingles pain that's lasting more than 3 or 6 months in duration, is one of the most excruciating pain syndromes that to treat. It is very challenging to treat, and often there aren't that many good answers to treat. So it is something that is quite painful. It often is like the worst sunburn sensation one could feel. And the problem is that with a sunburn, it typically goes away. With many of these patients, that pain continues.
So how do you treat something like that then for somebody who's in continuous pain?
Right. There's many different ways. One of them, it has been looked at where patients who had developed shingles but did not develop the condition postherpetic neuralgia, and this condition develops more often in people that are over the age of 60. So it's about, if you develop shingles, you may have about a 20-25% risk of developing postherpetic neuralgia. If you're under the age of 60, you may have a 10% chance of developing postherpetic. If you're over the age of 60, it's up to about 40%. So age is a big factor. So what we do is that patients who do have shingles, often what we've tried to do is to preempt or try to actually provide pain medication that hopefully will potentially lower the or decrease the risk of developing postherpetic neuralgia. Now, there's no evidence that that is the case, but we try to sometimes put them on medication and maybe in hope that it may help reduce the intensity of the pain. Medications that are typically used are anti-seizure, what's known as anti-seizure medications, which we now classify more as neuromodulators. These are drugs that modulate their pain and decrease the sensation of pain. Such drugs as Neurontin, such drugs as Lyrica or Cymbalta. The other agent that's often used and is one of a topical medication called Lidoderm, and it is FDA-approved for postherpetic neuralgia. Mm-hmm. And this is a patch that would be put on 12 hours on the site and 12 hours off. And that usually is on a frequent or daily basis.
And so do you see people, obviously you're seeing them in the severe stages of pain, but do you see them getting better, or is this something they really have to deal with medication and learn to live with?
Yeah, many times there's a mixture of medications that's used. There's also a new patch that's, I say new, it's relatively new compared to the other agents, of capsaicin. It's a high dose of what people may know as topically Zostrix, which is a very small amount of capsaicin, which is what's seen in pepper, and you see it in hot pepper. And this is a very high dose of a patch that also can help to deal with some of this pain. But most of patients who develop postherpetic neuralgia are going to require pain management probably for the rest of their life. There are some patients that do tend to get a lot better and don't require, you know, some chronic pain management, but the most of the patients that we see in our practice, they require a multitude of treatments, and so there's different ways of targeting the treatment. Like I said, there are anticonvulsants that are used, and which are now called neuromodulators, such as Neurontin or Lyrica, or other antidepressants, such as Cymbalta, and then we may add it to a very low dose of a painkiller, such as a short-acting medication like Percocet, or maybe a longer-acting agent, such as what everyone has heard of, OxyContin, or some other extended-release or long-acting opioid medication to maintain some better pain control. Mm. There are some simple methods that are used sometimes, which may sometimes be helpful, is that we'll ask them, because what happens, we'll ask them to actually take an ACE bandage, because these, let me explain this. When you have shingles, it's typically affecting a nerve, one nerve, and most commonly it's around the chest area. So when they have this pain, even wearing a shirt can be very uncomfortable. Even getting, you know, sleeping and lying down on that affected side can be very painful. So superficial touch can be quite painful. However, if you give them something where you give a strong stimulation, like a counter irritation, they may actually feel better. So what we'll do is ask them to wrap an ACE bandage tight around their chest, not so tight that it would cause them to stop breathing,
right,
but tight where they'll feel some sensation from the actual ACE bandage. And sometimes that type of sensation will actually help alleviate the pain. So a stronger stimulation will sometimes help to diminish the sensation of pain. A simple touch may make it feel quite excruciating. It's a very tough, difficult condition, and often these patients, it's so painful that they don't eat. Often they'll have a problem with, even if it's affecting the chest area, because it always typically affects one side, one nerve root. So that side is not just simply the chest area that's affected, but because it's so painful to even move that side, that they won't even move their arm. And so they can secondarily develop a frozen shoulder effect, so that now they have decreased movement of that right shoulder or left shoulder, depending upon the side that's affected. And so now they develop more problems. They become anorexic, so they don't eat, and then they have problems with their shoulder because they're not moving that affected side.
Right.
But it could affect any specific nerve root. It could be on the face, you know, typically on the forehead area. It could be in the chest, which I said is the most common area, in the thoracic region. But it could also present sometimes as a sciatica picture. So it can affect, it appear as if these patients are having a sciatic problem. Meanwhile, what they're having is a shingles problem affecting that nerve root. And often with these patients who present typically at onset, they'll have pain, and they've never felt that pain before. That pain is a very atypical sensation, like a burning and very sharp pain. And they'll go to the doctor, and the doctor doesn't see anything, just notes that there's excruciating pain. And the eruption of these marks on the skin that occur with shingles may take up to 2 weeks to present themselves. So often they're misdiagnosed the first few days or up to a week or two. And just think of someone presenting with chest pain, and they're thinking it's cardiac, can't find anything wrong with their heart. Meanwhile, a week or two later, there's an eruption on their chest that represents shingles. So often these patients are misdiagnosed the first week or two.
Right. And by the time you see them, have you figured out why certain people get this intense pain that lasts for a long time? Is it just they've had a heavier dose, if you will?
Well, they have looked at a couple of things, that if your pain at onset is quite intense, which is obviously subjective, but it's intense, and the number of you know, on a pain scale, say 0 to 10 is like an 8 over 10 or 9 or 10 over 10 at the onset when it starts, you're more likely to develop post-herpetic or shingles pain.
Okay.
If there are more lesions, that there are a lot of lesions, so skin marks that occur associated with shingles, if that seems to be that there is a high density of those marks, you're at a higher risk of developing post-herpetic neuralgia or shingles, pain following the actual shingles. The other, like I said earlier, age. Over the age of 60, you're at a greater risk of developing the pain that lasts for a long time compared to someone under the age of 60.
Okay. Well, all good information, Dr. Robert Duarte. I thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
And again, that was Dr. Robert A. Duarte. And you can find out more about him at NorthshoreLIJ.com. NorthshoreLIJ.com. Again, he's the director of the Pain Center at North Shore LIJ's Cushing Neuroscience Institute in Manhasset, New York. And their phone number is 516-325-7070. 516-325-7070. And just a couple of quick facts on the vaccine. It is only about 50% effective. And according to the CDC, there are conditions that where you should not take the vaccine. And that is if you have a life-threatening allergic reaction to gelatin and a couple of other things. You can look up on the CDC website and find this information. Weakened immune system because of HIV or because you're having drugs that affect the immune system, such as steroids, if you're having cancer treatment or radiation. But again, this is all up on the CDC website. So if you have questions, you can go there and find them out or call one of our guests today. And I'm sure they'd be happy to answer any questions you have. We're going to take a very quick break right now. And when we come back, we'll be joined by a listener, Maureen Taylor. And she's going to share the story of her father's journey with shingles. So we take a more personal look at this. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Designing Health, makers of The Missing Link, we cover the world of animals. This week, March 3rd, it's a Healing Sunday on Animal World with Dr. Nels Rasmussen. Exploring the unconscious brain's role in healing is the theme, and we'll discuss how his best therapy, hands-on and remote healing, relates to that. Plus, we'll take your phone calls and do some remote healing. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
I was leaving an exercise class.
All of a sudden, the pain started.
My entire chest.
Shortness of breath.
Very fatigued.
Nauseated.
Thought that it was nothing much, maybe just stress.
You're having a heart attack.
I'm healthy. I'm young. There's no way it could be my heart. No way.
Heart disease doesn't discriminate.
Listen to your body. Go get checked.
Heart disease is the number one killer in women.
And this is something that we can fight.
Visit GoRedForWomen.org to learn a woman's risk for heart disease.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Stay informed with news, traffic, and weather at the top of the hour, weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we're going to round out our talk about shingles this morning with a listener who called in after I'd mentioned it on the air that we were doing the show. And she called. And so I asked her if she'd join us and just share the story of her father's journey with shingles so we can get a more personal experience there. And Maureen Taylor, I'd like to welcome you to the show today.
Thank you, Vicky.
And you told me that your father had had shingles. So how old was your dad when he got it?
He was 88, and he had a gradual pain in his right shoulder, and it got worse during the night. So because of his health history, he went down to his hospital, and they admitted him.
Mm.
And he went home, and because they ruled out a lot of abdominal problems and checked his heart. And then he had more pain, so he went back a second time and went home because everything checked out okay. And then about 3 days later, he broke out with a rash all the way down from his upper back to his hand.
It seems that, according to both doctors and your experience with your father and my own experience, it seems to be misdiagnosed a lot in the beginning. I was interested to see that Dr. Robert Duarte said that a lot of people who have it on their chest actually think it's, heart problem when they first go in. So your dad's rash broke out about 3 days later, and it only ever affects one side of the body. So which side of the body?
So it was his right side of
his right
body.
Side?
And they gave him pain medication, but because of his age, he didn't tolerate the pain medicine. But he did take the Neurontin, the gabapentin for his the nerves, and it helped a little bit, but it, you know, just wipes you out. So after about 2 months of the post-herpetic neuralgia, he actually went to a pain clinic, and they gave him a nerve block, an outpatient procedure, a nerve block.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to help with him. He still had problems with his grip on his hand. It took months for the rash to even fade or go away. And to this day, he still has problems with two of his fingers, with neuropathy in the fingers.
Oh, that's interesting. So does he receive treatment today for that, or is it, you know, is it at the point where they say there's nothing we can do?
No, it's the point where they just say that, you know, not anything they can treat.
Mm. How did he cope with... I didn't have a great deal of itching myself. It was pain for me.
It was pain.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't. I think he got past that. He had the burning pain, but he mm-hmm. didn't have the itching.
And did they give him anything topical to put on?
You know, after he couldn't realize he couldn't take the pain medication, a compounding pharmacy makes a combination of the same medication as the Neurontin, and then they use some other factors in that pain medicine. And they put it into a compounding topical lotion that you can put on.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't help.
Mm.
So that's why he went to the nerve block. And I know sometimes even the nerve block they don't help some people, but it seemed to help him a little bit.
Yeah, and I asked that because I looked around to see if there was anything topical that was really effective. And there seems to be a lot of stuff out there from naturopaths, but I didn't come across anything that people would, you know, testify, hey, that was really effective.
No.
So how long did the actual, you know, there's kind of a point where you just have this pain all the time, and then all of a sudden you realize, wait, it's dissipating. How long was that for your dad?
I would say with him it was probably about 5 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, 5 months. And it was interesting because the medication, you know, they were saying the medication, you can give it at any time. It's best if you can give it in the beginning. But they didn't give him the medicine for about 2 weeks into his diagnosis. So.
Yeah. I didn't get any medicine. I went to the emergency room because I seriously felt, I know this sounds really silly and I'm going to say this on air, but you see these horror shows all the time where people are bit by insects and they lay eggs in them. And I seriously thought... And I thought a spider had bit me and laid eggs in me, and I had all these little spiders running around my scalp and it was painful. And because I was misdiagnosed, he said, yes, it's an insect bite.
Yeah.
By the time I got to my real doctor, it was too late for any kind of medication. But I do remember sleeping with my head hanging over the edge of the bed for about 6 months because I couldn't bear to have my hair on the pillow.
Do you still have symptoms now, or is yours?
Not really. I sometimes get a strange tingling, but not really.
Good.
So, so as far as your dad's neuropathy in his fingers, is that they pretty much said that there's nothing they can do. That's going to be it.
Yeah.
And how did he feel? Did he get depressed at all, Maureen? Because
he got discouraged because he's pretty active for 89.
Yeah.
I mean, he was golfing up until a couple years ago, even with all the conditions he's had over the last couple of years. So. Yeah, it slowed him down for quite a while.
Great.
And I think that discouraged him. But then I think what I've heard from you say that even over the age of 60, the vaccine is only 50% effective. So,
According to all the studies I looked at, it's only 50% effective.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, I really appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you for asking me. I'm really grateful that he's still here and that he survived this nasty disease.
Yes, it is nasty. And I hope, you know, listeners got a different perspective on hearing his side of things and listening to our two experts talk this morning.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Maureen. Appreciate it.
Bye.
And it's Maureen Taylor. And do stay with us when we come back. We're going to be joined by Jennifer Haig, who is a superb writer. We're going to totally shift gears here, all right? You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Coming soon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out what drives us to compete when we talk with number one New York Times bestselling author Poe Bronson, author of Top Dog. We'll also talk to Pam Jenoff about her latest historical novel set in Paris during 1919. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And see conversationslive.net for details and more than 200 archived podcasts.
I was leaving an exercise class.
All of a sudden, the pain started.
My entire chest.
Shortness of breath.
Very fatigued.
Nauseated.
Thought that it was nothing much, maybe just stress.
You're having a heart attack.
I'm healthy. I'm young. There's no way it could be my heart. No way.
Heart disease doesn't discriminate.
Listen to your body. Go get checked.
Heart disease is the number one killer in women.
And this is something that we can fight.
Visit GoRedForWomen.org to learn a woman's risk for heart disease.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Spread the word. Your favorite shows are on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. I promised you at the top of the hour that Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair would escape with a little fiction toward the end of the show. And my guest is Jennifer Haig. I'm pleased to welcome her back. She joined us once before. She's the author of the short story collection News from Heaven and also four critically acclaimed novels, including a New York Times bestseller. Her books include Faith, The Condition, Baker Towers, and Mrs. Kimball. And her work won both the Penn Hemingway Award for Debut Fiction and the Penn L.L. Winship Award for a New England Writer. Her short fiction has been published widely in The Atlantic, Granta, The American Short Stories 2012, The Best American Short Stories 2012, and many other publications. Jennifer Haig, welcome.
Thank you.
Pleased to have you back on the show. You're joining us from the Boston area, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And this book is called News from Heaven. I think last time we talked about the book Faith, which was based on a somewhat controversial subject. Totally different vein here. So I want to talk a little bit about why go to short stories. I know you write short stories, but why did you want to do a book on short stories?
You know, I was a short story writer long before I was a novelist. It's the form I first fell in love with, and I've never really stopped writing them. But as you say, this is the first time I've published short stories in book form. I think short stories were the ideal form for this particular story because it is in some ways a fragmentary story. News from Heaven returns to the same landscape as my second novel, Baker Towers. It's set in a little coal mining town in western Pennsylvania. In that book, Baker Towers, I told the story of the life cycle of the coal mine, sort of the cycling from boom to bust and how this affected one family in the town. And in News from Heaven, I return to that place, but it's sort of an updating of that story. Many of the short stories in the collection take place in the present day, so we kind of get to see what happens to the town of Bakerton 30, 40 years on.
Right. What I found interesting is that you looked at something that I think is a fairly common theme in humanity, but it can be a very tortuous state to find yourself in, and that's the conflicting human desires for escape and connection, which were pretty much woven throughout the stories in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a conscious decision when you set out to write these stories?
I was very much aware of it. All 10 of these stories are either set in the town of Bakerton or concern characters who have left and have deeply ambivalent feelings about having left their hometown. So whether you stay or go, the fact of being from this place is very formative for these characters. And really, none of them ever achieves absolute peace about the decision of whether to stay or whether to go.
Right. Is that something you've struggled with? I seem to remember last time we talked, you had moved, or no?
Well, I've been in Boston for a good long time, but I did grow up in a town very much like Bakerton, Pennsylvania. And I have had very sort of conflicting feelings about that place. I still have a great tenderness for it. My family still lives there, and I go back when I can once or twice a year. But I always leave the place with a complex kind of sadness. I'm glad to be going back to my real life, and yet I feel this inexorable pull toward this place that I came from. And I think it's not an unusual experience.
I think it's a very common experience, something that I've had, you know, with England and America.
Sure.
Not just around the corner either. Mm-hmm. So you exploring that hold of home, tell us what your favorite story was in the book. Do you have a favorite story, or are you going to tell me, no, it's like choosing one of my children?
Well, it is a bit like choosing one of my children. I will say that my favorite story is the one I have most recently read or worked on. So because I did a reading a few days ago and I read the story Favorite Son, that one is uppermost in my mind. I could do a reading tomorrow, choose a different story, and have an entirely different feeling. But at the moment, that story Favorite Son is very much with me. It's the story about sort of a local hero, a sports hero, who seems to have a very bright future and manages to leave the town of Bakerton, but his life does not turn out the way everybody expected it to.
Right. And what is it in particular about that story that grabs you?
Oh, I think there is a kind of mythology around this young man in the town, and he's held in very high regard, even after it's clear that his life isn't going to be a great success story. His is a story that is repeated and repeated in the town, and that is very much true to my experience of living in a small town where nothing is ever forgotten, for good or for bad.
Right, right. Plus, there's the pros and the cons. So you are known for developing characters who we describe as human. Their backgrounds, their families, places they were raised have shaped them, just as we ourselves are shaped by those same references. And I think that's what I have to tell you. I have to be real honest. I don't usually like short stories, but I was drawn right into this. I actually sat down last weekend and read a couple of the stories on the beach in the cold, but it was sunny. And so and I got drawn straight in. From your perspective, when you're choosing your characters, talk to us a little bit about how you bring them to life.
Well, I think to write a fictional character, whether it's in a novel or a short story, I find it necessary to think a lot about that person's early experiences. So, you know, parents and siblings and early childhood and school experiences. And in this way, I often find myself writing about families, not because I have a particular interest in families, it's just that I find it impossible to write a well-developed character unless I go back to the very beginning. So all of my four novels are in some way family stories, again, just because I was doing the legwork of figuring out who these characters were, and in the process found myself very interested in the people close to them.
Mm. Now, these stories, some of these were published in The Atlanta, for example, and some of them presumably you wrote for the book. Is that right?
You know, they were nearly all published individually. All but one have been published individually. I would say for several years I wrote these stories without any intention of collecting them in a book. And what happened over time was that I saw a larger story emerging when these stories were placed side by side. So after having written about four or five of them, it was clear to me that, yes, this is going to be a book.
Right. And you've been compared a couple of times, especially Baker Towers, I know that, but I also saw it on a couple of blogs that you were hailed as a modern classic writer. How does that make you feel?
Very, very old.
Oh! Well, you know, the short stories that spring to mind that I do like are Kate Chopin's short stories.
Oh, yes.
and Catherine Mansfield's Miss Brill. I love that story. It's so sad in so many ways. But, you know, until I'd read your book and your short stories, those really were the only short stories I'd really connected with. And I do think it's because they had really strong character development, just like you do. So where do you see this? Do you see this progressing into another book, or are you working on a novel right now, full-length novel?
It's hard to know. I will always write short stories, and you know, I have one going at the moment, but I also have a novel started, and I think the next thing I publish will likely be another novel. It takes me, it seems counterintuitive, but it takes me much longer to finish a collection of short stories than it does to write a novel. And I think it's because a short story collection has so many unrelated moving parts. I have a very hard time finishing work of any kind. And to finish a short story collection, you have to declare all 10 stories finished. Whereas a novel is only one thing to finish. It's a very large thing,
right.
But you only have to say, I'm done once.
Right.
So with News from Heaven, which was under contract for years and years as I struggled to finish it, what would happen was I would have 8 or 9 stories I was perfectly happy with and think, I just want to write one more. And in the process of writing one more, I would find that I'd outgrown one of the older stories and it was no longer satisfactory, so I had to come up with yet another. My editor and I used to joke that this was the book they would publish posthumously because there was no way I was ever going to finish all 10 of the stories. And I'm still a bit amazed that it is finished and out there in the world.
Well, I think also having the first of all, we're glad you're here and it's not published posthumously. But I would think having the stories interconnected, and you've done that so well because it's not obvious that you're looking to make that connection in the story. You know, you don't go, aha, there's the connection. I would think that's a challenge in itself.
It is. And, you know, it's not something that I was aware of doing initially. These stories were, in a way, started out as outtakes from the novel. They were pieces of story that did not fit into the framework of Baker Towers. For instance, there is a character in Baker Towers, the youngest son in the Novak family, who's sort of a prodigal son. He disappears and is not seen again in this town for many years. In writing the stories in News from Heaven, I found that I had more to say about this character that did not fit into that other novel. So in News from Heaven, he gets 2 stories of his own. And that's happened with several other characters from Baker Towers. His older sister, Joyce, Miss Peel, the schoolmistress. Several of these characters get more time in the short stories.
Mm.
So it was something I really just backed into.
And I remember when we talked before, you said that research is really critical for you. You do a lot of research. These stories span from World War II through modern day. What kind of research was involved in putting this together?
You know, I did much less research for this book than I'm accustomed to doing. And I think there are 2 reasons for this. One is that this landscape is intensely familiar to me because it's a place where I've spent a portion of my own life. But secondly, I did a lot of research putting together Baker Towers, the novel. And because I had already created that landscape in my imagination, it was a simple matter to sort of bring that back to mind. So in a way, I had done all of this research already. All the legwork had been done.
Yeah. Well, well done. Job well done. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Jennifer?
Well, I think it's the short story form is in the midst of enjoying a kind of resurgence. I can't tell you how many readers have told me just what you told me, that, well, I don't normally read short stories,
right,
but I like these, and here's why. And, you know, I think that in many ways short stories are an ideal fit for the way we live now, where we have less and less discretionary time, less time to read. It's marvelous, I think, to be able to sit down and have a complete experience of a story that gives you some kind of resolution at the end in, you know, 20 minutes or half an hour.
Yeah.
And it's something that you just can't get in a novel. So, you know, I think the short story is here to stay.
I would agree with you. I mean, I just, I really did enjoy them. And I think, you know, it's a testament to your character development and storytelling, because the problem I've had with short stories before is lack of character development and lack of storytelling, really. So
it's a very challenging form, you know. I've always felt there's sort of a hierarchy to literary forms, with poetry at the top of the pyramid and novels at the bottom. Writing a poem, if you get one word wrong, you blew it.
Right.
And in a novel, you can get a whole chapter wrong. And if it's interesting and well-written, the reader will probably hang in there with you.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a great book. It's called News from Heaven. Jennifer Haig is my guest and the author of this book, News from Heaven. You can find out more about Jennifer at jenniferhaig.com. jenniferhaig.com. And Haig is spelled H-A-I-G-H, JenniferHaig.com. Thanks for being with us, Jennifer. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you, Vicky.
And thanks to each of you for tuning in today and spending this hour with us. If you have any questions on today's show or feedback, you can reach me at info@conversationslive.net, or at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.